Hello and welcome to Node Up, episode number 42. Today we're going to be talking about scaling WebSockets. I'm Daniel Shaw, joined today by Arnaud, Third Eden, Mike Revort, and Brett Kiefer are all on. Mike's from Pearson Education, and Brett is from Trello, a new addition to the Node Up experience. So we're going to be talking about scaling WebSockets. Invariably, we'll also sort of dive into scaling Socket.io. Since you're pushing this out into production, invariably Socket.io comes into the mix. Interestingly enough, this is a bit full circle for me. I, one of my early claims to fame in the Node community was, scaling Socket.io and WebSockets. And my introduction to Node was WebSockets, and that's kind of where I started my adventure. I've been at Voxer for about a year and a half, and we do not use Socket.io or WebSockets for that matter, because of the mobile connections that we try to optimize. We end up using XHR. So great to dive back into that adventure and hear the screams of pain of people using Redis Store on Socket.io. Arnaud, do you want to tell us a little about yourself and how you got here?
I've started using Socket.io early on with when I started the knockout competition, the first one. There was so much shit going on in Socket.io that I just had to fix it, and I basically just rolled into real-time. I started deploying large real-time systems for online auctions. Now I'm doing a little bit less of real-time. My own startup, ObserveIt, is using real-time really heavily. We're currently developing scalability features for it. That's also the reason why we started the load balancer battle, to figure out which load balancer is the best. And at Nojitsu, we're also using Socket.io and recently switched over to Engine.io because of all the issues that we saw with Socket.io. So that's about it. What about you, Mike?
And I'm Mike Revort. I live in Denver, Colorado. I work for Pearson, like Daniel said. And I've been using Node for about 2.5 years now, I think. 3 years, 2.5 years in production, and probably at Socket.io in production for about a year or so, year plus. I wouldn't call it significant scale, but sort of planning. We're on the trajectory to really start to ramp up. So have been, at least architecturally trying to, cut off any of the anticipated issues, at least what you can see via, any type of load testing, and just looking at, architectural constraints of, which I guess we'll talk about a little bit, how you go about scaling up Socket.io or even WebSockets, having those run in Node and bound to a particular process, how you scale those out, across multiple processes and across regions and higher latencies and those types of things. But I guess that's it.
And I'm Brett. Socket.io was actually my intro to Node.js. In fact, had Socket.io not been so easy to get started with, Trello would probably not be written, probably would not be a Node app. I was fooling around with a zombie tower defense game that I was writing to be multiplayer in my free time. And it was originally written in Haskell, and this was when the standard for WebSockets was changing all of the time. Socket.io had the up-to-date implementation that actually worked with the current standard. So I was like, wow, this is so easy to get started with. And so when the time came to prototype Trello, I was like, well, this would be really neat. We could just have JavaScript on the server and JavaScript on the client and just, do RPC back and forth, and it'll be awesome. And it was. It was a really awesome prototyping environment, and we were enjoying ourselves so much that we thought, well, maybe this could work for the real thing. So we stuck with it, and Trello's still a Node app today, and we're very happy with it.
That's awesome. So Whiffasniff, how's WebSockets are fun. Socket.io is fun. GIF. Anyway, that's fantastic. JavaScript. JavaScript is fun, so Node is fun. That's great. Socket.io really has been the intro to Node for a lot of people, and it's a very important piece of the puzzle. So, going around the horn like that, it sounds like Socket.io is still kind of the definition of how people are going into WebSockets and exploring WebSockets. I've seen recently with like Mozilla's tow truck, they are just doing pure WebSockets. It's always enticing to go back to that. That's where I originally started. I was working with Michael Smith's WebSocket server back in the day. I think that predates Socket.io. Do you guys remember?
It doesn't predate Socket.io.
Sort of goes about the same time. That project is no longer around. Just maintaining the various specs, I think, ended up killing off that project. But the various specs, just purely dealing with WebSockets and the various specs involved in supporting that, tends to push people to Socket.io. And I agree with Brett. It's a really fantastic API.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that if you're going to go the tow truck route, you have to decide one or two things. Either you're only going to accept WebSockets and that's it, and if you can't connect via WebSocket, you can't use the app, which is potentially okay for something like tow truck that's sort of free and an experiment. Or, if you're just going to use WebSockets and not do anything else for, two-way sort of server push bidirectional communication, then you need some other acceptable fallback, either, some polling-based fallback that's not long polling, or whatever, that, your app sort of gracefully degrades and you've got to decide one of those two things. Otherwise, you're sort of stuck in the middle.
Right. Yeah, the reality of production invariably pushes you to some alternative. It's rare that any reasonable project that's intended to be in front of users does not need a fallback. They can deal with, throwing away so many users.
And the challenge of it is it's not just like a browser compatibility issue thing where you say, hey, if you just upgrade, from IA8 to whatever, there's so many other variables in play for why you may or may not be able to establish a WebSocket connection or keep it.
Absolutely. We've been very happy to have had a short polling fallback outside of Socket.io with Trello. In fact, after launch, when we were having difficulty with scaling Socket.io with any of the transports, we fell back completely to that. That had the additional advantage that we could really tweak the performance trade-off there, because we could we could adjust our idle polling time and we could adjust our active polling time for based on whether a user was active or idle. And as long as we kept our HTTP connections open for a reasonably long time, that was very efficient, and that allowed us to kind of degrade gracefully even when our servers couldn't handle the load right after launch.
Interesting. So you're doing that outside of Socket.io.
That's right. We just I implemented a quick queue, object delta queue in Redis, and this is actually also what we use. When you lose your Socket.io, or rather, since we only use WebSockets, when you lose your WebSocket for a while and reconnect, what you're doing is sending the same ID that you would send if you were on short polling, and then you get whatever's in that queue. For all I know, Socket.io may do this for you now, but we haven't upgraded in quite some time.
So what version of Socket.io are you running?
We're running a patched version of 0.8-something.
Okay. Yeah, my experience at Spreecast was basically the reality of running production Socket.io is that you live in your fork.
Yep. Well, I mean, the main patch for us was just to, after turning off all the down-level transports and just using polling there, the main patch for us was to get away from this problem with the order n unsubscribe in Redis. You know, because every single process would subscribe to a channel per WebSocket, right, or per Socket.io connection, right. And that was fine on the subscribe, which is order one, but then the unsubscribe is order n. So when a bunch of people are disconnecting, Redis, you know, explodes, and it's hard to explode Redis.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
That thing is solid, right? So that was the main patch. I think it's on. It's actually still an open bug with our patch on it. It's like case 686 on Socket.io on GitHub.
Okay, we'll have to make sure we put that in the show notes. That'll be interesting for people to go and follow up on.
Yeah, the biggest problem that people are having with WebSockets is that they don't know that transparent proxies or virus scanners are actually blocking the WebSockets. I mean, everybody just assumes that WebSockets works everywhere, even if your browser supports it. But they forget like these annoying pieces of software on computers or in servers or even on your providers, that these just eat up your WebSocket connections. And Socket.io wasn't designed to handle this. So this is really annoying when you're using Socket.io at the moment. It just doesn't fall back correctly to polling transports, which is probably also the reason why you created a separate polling system besides Socket.io.
That's right. Yes. I mean, you know, a lot of that, as you mentioned in the notes for the show, you know, SSL does eliminate a lot of the problems. The day we went to doing absolutely everything over SSL, everything started going a lot better.
Yeah, that's definitely true, right? Because the you know, proxies in the middle, they just see, you know, encrypted packets going by, and they just tend to sort of let those go by without doing any sort of state inspection on it. So yeah, we've obviously had the same experience of having a much greater reliability and ability to, you know, connect, establish, and keep a WebSocket connection over SSL. Sure.
So is there I actually don't know. Have they gone beyond the Redis store for Socket.io managing multipresses Socket.io?
As far as I know, they're rewriting Socket.io at the moment to Socket.io 1. But they're still doing a Redis store. But there are other people in the community who have stepped up and started implementing the same store in MongoDB or in any other message queue system.
Yeah. So, have you seen? Have you heard of anyone taking the Mongo implementation to any sort of real scale? I know that you know it is a successful proof of concept. I haven't heard of anybody that's taken it into production and really pushed it out.
I don't know. It seems like a sort of a strange way to go.
Yeah. I think it only makes sense if you want to have a really simple stack on your server. If you're already using MongoDB, then it might make sense to just go with a MongoDB store instead of deploying another Redis server or something like that.
It makes sense from that perspective. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, so instead what we're doing is I ripped out all the – we're not using the Redis store anymore. And basically
or
just
stores. Or the concept of store, right?
Yeah, so yeah, we're not using the Socket.io store at all. We really just neutered Socket.io to just be a transport and just handle the, you know, using its API, but not using it to store any data about the socket or being able to look up any data about any other sockets. And instead have written a layer, which I have to get around to releasing and making sure I can release, that we're using Redis for PubSub, but it's completely separated from Socket.io. So, and it aggregates subscriptions across that process. So one of the things that, one of the problems I had with Socket.io was that, like Brett said, it was super chatty. And, I worked through for about 3 weeks a bug. It was a race condition between when one of the not persistent socket fallbacks, like a long polling connection, disconnects and then reconnects. There's this tiny window between that happening where you'd actually miss messages. It was the time between it was sending the unsubscribe to Redis and the time that that it sort of moves on. There's a tiny window there. And then, in the depths of all that code, just became really uncomfortable with the amount of traffic and how chatty it was. So instead, we do is we manage, sort of in process, each socket can subscribe to Redis channels. And then in aggregate, that process will subscribe to the channels, the particular channels in Redis on that connection from, to the connections to Redis on that process. So that, with the Redis store Socket.io implementation, like every process, at least what I observed, every process got every single message that was broadcast. And then it checked to see if any of the sockets, had anybody interested, anybody in that room to deliver it. Where in this case, if you publish something and nobody on that process for that socket is subscribed to that, then, Redis won't deliver that. So just really leaning on Redis PubSub to do all that work for you. So I have that, and then I have another fork of that I created just last week with ZeroMQ, and then using Substack Cport library to do all of the sort of dynamic configuration of that, because it's ZeroMQ without a broker, so everybody's sort of connected to, at least in the POC, everybody's connected to everybody. But so anyway, long story short, moved away from the Redis store primarily because I really didn't think it was a good idea ahead from a scaling perspective, really trying very hard to keep with the view that, if we can make it so that a socket on a particular server doesn't need to know about any other sockets in a concrete way, they kind of can in at least our use cases, it could be very abstract. So, if I publish something, I'm not necessarily messaging another socket from another socket. I may be publishing to some Redis channel that is, either based on a particular user or a session or some abstract thing. Been trying really hard not to share data between sockets, and feeling it's a much better way to scale this thing going forward.
Yeah, I think that's a great policy in general with Node. The more you can do that, the more basically, things are happy. And it reduces complexity and makes scaling easier. My go-to talk right now basically covers that evolution of, dumb processes to very stateful processes, and encouraging the staying as dumb as possible for as long as possible.
It is interesting to hear how much it sounds like some of the work has been reproduced just by people on this call, and I think that partially sort of speaks to how quickly Socket.io can become, critical to your stack. And then, you absolutely have to fix it. But, I think everyone here is working on production software. And so there's this sort of feeling that you don't really quite have time to, to share it or to maintain a fork or to try to, to try to contribute that stuff back. So you end up just throwing a patch out there and saying, here's what I've got. I got other things to do. It's sort of, but it is, it is very, it does become very critical, and hence, we get all of these sort of production forks of it.
So everybody on the call is primarily Socket.io. Has anybody tried anything else? Like, has anybody tried Socks.js?
CoffeeScript. Sorry. I don't want
to. That's my biggest problem with it as well. It makes it so hard to contribute. I don't even want to start with it if I can't even normally contribute to a project.
Sorry. The objection is that it's written in CoffeeScript.
Yeah.
Oh well, we'd probably find that easier. All of Trello is in CoffeeScript. We kind of love it over here.
Oh, there you go. Great.
But I know there are some nigh religious arguments going on about it right now. But our mileage has been good. That's interesting. No, we haven't tried anything else since we've had Socket.io, working beautifully for the last year or so.
Yes, yeah, so Socket.js is definitely the go-to alternative there. So with node modules, especially node modules that are such key bits of the architecture. I don't have any objections with CoffeeScript in principle, but I know from experience that I'll sooner or later sooner rather than later probably will go back in and have to contribute back to the project. I'm going to be stressing the infrastructure so much that's going to happen. So that's always been something that slowed me down with that. Substack went from Socket.io to Socket.js, and as far as I can recall, he's been very happy with it.
Yeah, I've noticed that as well. And that is a concern. It's funny when you were asking about what version of Socket.io you're running in production. I kind of flipped and looked, and I was like, "Oh, that's right! I'm running off my own fork." I forget.
Yep.
It's invariably,
right?
so that's Arno, you bring up a great point, right? That and that's that point of like any piece of, especially key infrastructure like this, you have to be willing to own it, and it just becomes just another barrier. It's not a like unovercomable sort of barrier, but it's challenging if you don't write CoffeeScript, all the time. And the reason like a lot of us write JavaScript in the client and the server is one. That eliminating that context switching does have lots of benefits, and just I find going back and forth. I can barely contribute to pull requests back to open source projects and just get like tabs versus spaces right. be like, all right, I want to just change my editor, change all the tabs and spaces on someone's pull request, let alone keep up with the difference to CoffeeScript. But CoffeeScript is just another language, and I guess. Whatever sort of floats your boat, but I can understand that hesitation.
So we talked about Engine.io potentially being the future. Arno, you've spent the most time with Engine.io. What does the Engine.io do that changes things for us, and how is it going to improve the reliability?
The biggest change that Engine.io has, it's the way that it's connecting to your server. With Socket.io, it always tries to select the best transport possible on your browser. So it usually starts with WebSockets. But as we've learned that WebSockets are really hard to connect with because of all these proxies and firewalls, it was causing all these issues. So with Engine.io, it's actually started with the least performant but most reliant transport, and that's JSON polling. During all these polling requests to the server, it will send a probe using a different transport to the server. When it's able to connect using that probe, the other polling transport will die off, and the probed transport will be promoted to the stable connection. And this will just continue until you reach WebSockets. So that's the biggest change between Socket.io and Engine.io internally. But Engine.io in general is much more low level than Socket.io. It doesn't have namespaces, rooms, or automatic decoding of JSON, or even emit events. So it's really low level. It's something that the new Socket.io 1.0 will be built upon to provide all these features that it's missing.
I like that simplicity, though. Going back to the roots of just working directly with WebSockets. There's a really nice, simple API.
Yeah, and that's also one of the reasons that most people were using Socket.js. I mean, it's much less magical than Socket.io.
That's a good point. Right.
And sometimes you don't want the overhead of doing all the JSON parses, right?
Yeah, that's true. But Engine.io still has its own protocol on top of WebSockets, so it still adds some sort of overhead.
Got it. So the movement to being basically pessimistic. So Socket.io was optimistic and working at the best possible connection, working down to pessimistic really matches the underlying network protocols and how things happen there. So it's a really nice move, and I'm excited to see how that comes into play with Socket.io. One of the maintenance challenges with Socket.io is also the complexity. So working with Engine.io might give people that are having issues with all the various pieces fitting together, use smaller pieces and switch out, like Brett has his own short pulling solutions, switch out that solution with your own infrastructure that you own. I like that.
Yeah, I agree. And we had Socket.io deployed at Nojitsu, and we were seeing all these kind of crazy little issues. And one of these issues were that Socket.io decided to DDoS our own server by creating a client-side loop and starting hundreds or thousands connections in just minutes. We migrated then to Engine.io. It was a couple of lines of code changes, not more than 50 changes. Wow. And we saw a really improve of our connectivity of the sockets, as well as a major reduction of our server resources. So it's definitely ready for production.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think you touched on something there that's not obvious when you're going into WebSockets and persistent connections, which is just how easy it is to DDoS yourself.
Yeah.
When everybody disconnects and reconnects and just annihilates your server. I managed to self DDoS several times, just because we would have tens of thousands of people connected, and then we're a very new product, we'd have a crash, everything would these connections would all be severed, and then we'd have 5-10 minutes of downtime while we managed to get everybody reconnected. It's something to be wary of when you're dipping your toe into WebSockets.
Yeah, especially if you're doing really large scale deployments. I mean, one silly little mistake can just completely tear down your cluster.
Right. Well, I mean, this was with XHR, but the reason why we had to put a proxy in front of our connections at Voxer was basically because of that. We have sticky home sessions, and all of our if a node went down or restarted a node, we'd have a bunch of people coming in and doing the SSL handshake, and it basically blocked the event loop, and was killing the interaction for everybody associated with that node.
And that's because you were doing the SSL offloading in process and node, right?
Exactly, right. So last year we had to drop doing that, and now we have stud in front of our processes. But we're supporting making that better in node. Fedora is working with us on that, and it's been great, but it's still lots of work to do.
What about percentage of clients that are able to connect via WebSockets? Do people see that getting better?
Trello, we've sort of always been jerks about this, about only supporting the latest versions of the most popular browsers. It was just, it was a single page app, and it was trying to do something kind of cool and at the time, kind of magical feeling. We started with a fairly high percentage, it has been getting better.
Yeah, I've seen the same thing. We're kind of in the same boat, but I'd be curious to get some good stats on that, because it's like the same as the stats with usage on IE8, IE7, etc. At the point where you sort of flip the switch and turn off support, where the challenge again with WebSockets though is there's always going to be the case where you're not going to be able to connect, just with the nature of sort of the internet and proxy servers and such. But it definitely helps make that decision. If you say, well, if that's 1% of the time, that might be a reasonable trade-off to get to that point where you know, you just go pure WebSockets like we were talking about earlier, because ultimately, you know, it's kind of a crutch, right? It's a synthesized you know, sort of mechanism for trying to, you know, ease your you know, ability to sort of program in that paradigm, but, you know, it's ultimately a hack, right?
So has the protocol now stabilized? Are we, like, are we good, or are we good enough, or have we gotten there yet?
It's an RFC now.
Okay. So,
you can say things are pretty close.
Yeah, right. So, you know, barring some, you know, new attack vector, there's a fair chance that we're going to be living with this as the protocol for, you know, a few years. Maybe. Probably not.
the internet's done. It's just done.
The internet's done. All right, right.
Put a bow on it.
About time.
and Internet Explorer's gone away, right? Oh man. So all right, I'm gonna talk up for a moment about our sponsor, Bizzler. Bizzler is a longtime sponsor of NodeUp, and we're super happy to have them on board. They are originally from Australia and the source of much fun and excitement with kangaroo jokes and whatnot. They're actually now in San Francisco, or they have their main office in San Francisco, and they are hiring Node developers there. Bring your fosters when you come to your interview, and I'm sure they'll appreciate that. And check them out on Twitter at Bizzler. That's BISLR. And Bizzler.com. We'll have a note in the show notes to the Node developer role, and it's a little bit too long to read out. It's like Bizzler about careers, Node.js. But I'm sure if you Google Bizzler, BISLR, Node developer, that'll pop up right away. So thank you, Bizzler, and we really appreciate it.
Isn't Foster's like the Budweiser of beers?
Totally. That's a bit of a troll. Yeah, totally.
They really like it if you make an Australia joke in the interview. In fact, if you don't, then it's a no hire. So make sure you do.
That's right.
Yeah. Do your best. Like, you know, like when you put forth the best effort and at least try the accent. Just try it the best you can. If you do the whole interview, it's just like, bonus points. Bring your Fosters, you know.
Put the shrimp on the Barbie.
And I'm like, oh, I feel good. I miss home.
You must be extraordinarily talented with the JavaScript. So thanks a lot, Bizzler. We really appreciate it. So, Arno, you've been doing some really cool stuff with, beating up load balancers and figuring out how that works with WebSockets. Can you tell us a little bit more what you're doing with that?
The reason why I started doing this is because you didn't have that many proxies that supported WebSockets when WebSockets were first introduced. I mean, you had HA proxy who was able to proxy WebSockets in TCP mode. Quickly after that, you had a load balancer that was created by Nojitsu, the Node HTTP proxy, which was also capable of doing WebSocket. But that's about it. I mean, you had Nginx, who was completely broken when you use WebSockets, and Apache. I mean, come on, nobody uses Apache for proxying. we're a couple of more years further now, and I needed a proxy for my own startup. I mean, you're thinking of these architectures and you just want to make sure that you make the best decision possible for your own architecture. So I started to research a bit, and I found out that most load balancers are now capable of supporting WebSockets. They're not yet in the stable branches, but most of the development versions are capable of doing WebSockets. the biggest thing I wanted to figure out what was the best scaling proxy out there. So I started testing the HTTP proxy from Nojitsu because it's something that we're also using at Nojitsu. It works really well, but the biggest problem with it is that it's using Node, so it's quite heavy on the memory when you first start it up. I mean, Node starts up with like 12 megabytes of memory. And if you compare that to Nginx, who starts with like 0 megabytes, and HA proxy as well, that can really get heavy, especially when you're trying to accept as much connections as possible. What I saw with the HTTP proxy is that it really started to get heavy around like 10,000 connections. The memory spiked up to like 200 megabytes of memory, while Nginx or HA proxy were around like 20 megabytes. I mean, that's a huge difference.
Did you see a lot of jitteriness, you know, because of the GC in Node with HTTP proxy?
Not really. I mean, if I looked at the latency for the requests, you do see that HTTP proxy is slower than the others, but it's not that bad. I mean, it's doable. You have like a latency of 40 milliseconds versus 50 milliseconds on Nginx.
But was the range different? Like, was the upper sort of higher, the spread different for HTTP? I would expect it to be, just because, you know, you see where you have periodic GCs with a node that is the freeze the world type GC, which you know, you don't in some of these other proxies.
Let me check it out. I mean, I have the results in the GitHub repository.
Let's get some real numbers in here.
Real numbers.
I really, really enjoyed this article. It came out like a week ago, right? It was writing up on Hacker News.
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this. I was surprised at the that Stud made such a difference in front of HAProxy.
But that was mostly because of a configuration fuck up on my side. HAProxy recently had SSL termination landed. So I just misconfigured SSL, so it performed really poorly. After a few tips from Hacker News, I mean, it's outperformed Stud.
Okay.
That's really nice.
I'm sorry, and you were looking for some results. Please go ahead. I can keep talking while you look.
I mean, if you look at the maximum latency that you see on HA proxy versus HTTP proxy, there isn't really that much of a latency when it comes to messaging. But when you look at the handshaking, there's a really big difference. I don't know why there's that a big difference. I mean, HA proxy had a maximum of like 1 second, and the HTTP proxy around 2 seconds. So it's quite odd, but it could be related to garbage collection or something like that.
Yeah, we've had really good luck with HAProxy since we've originally it was just proxying TCP straight to all of the backend node processes which were running on cluster, and I guess a couple of months ago we went to HAProxy as our SSL terminator and also proxying the proxying WebSockets rather than just proxying TCP. We've been very happy with it. So I guess that's the configuration that you're kind of ending up recommending here.
I've been personally been switching between Nginx and HAProxy, but HAProxy has its advantages. I mean, it has more load balancing capabilities than Nginx, but Nginx is easier to control externally because you can script it with Lua, for example, while HAProxy has a Unix socket which you can use to turn off and turn on some servers, but that's about it.
Wow, that you couldn't give me a better segue to basically point to what Mike's been doing, right? You've been working on controlling a bunch of HA proxies.
Yeah, so same thing. We use HA proxy and we're currently using Stud, and now I'm very encouraged to try HA proxy doing the offloading itself. So we use HA proxy as a load balancer mechanism for many things, that many apps, and not just Node apps, but also some Java apps and some other things. We wanted to find a much better way to dynamically configure it, especially since we don't have, like at Pearson, we have a lot of apps, lots of different apps. I guess it's similar to hosting other people's apps, but there are apps. So there's lots of differences, and it's not like we're trying to scale one big app. So we have many HA proxy servers. And we like like Arno said, we like HA proxy's capabilities. It's just a little bit cumbersome from a configuration management perspective. So what really led us to create something to dynamically control HA proxy was that we wanted to have the ability to do, no downtime, like AB style deployments. And we have a lot of infrastructure in AWS now. And so on every deployment, we end up spinning up whole new app instances from the ground up. And sort of underpinned in this whole environment is a wrapper around Substack's Seaport library, which is a pretty lightweight in-memory registry where services can connect and register and say, I'm this app at this version of this host and port. So we have that. And then each app sort of wraps the Seaport client in a module that checks in and says that, I'm this app in this version, I'm on this host and port. As well as if you have like a Java service deployed or Python or some other service, you could start up that node service sort of next to it, as a dependent service to say, on when this one starts this other one, when the other one drops, stop the other one. And configure it to basically announce the Seaport to say, hey, here's this thing over here, he's on this host and port, and he's this app in this version. And then we have a process, a little node process that runs next to each HA proxy server, which provides one, a RESTful API to basically to that HA proxy. So you can configure front ends and back ends and routing rules. And the RESTful API is really geared towards not exposing any very, very specific HA proxy things, because we're experimenting using that for other proxy servers as well. We have some infrastructure in our own data centers that use like a big IP F5 big IP appliance, and there's experiments to have this process actually configure that as well. So what it does is this RESTful API to this thing called Aqueduct is the name of the process in XHA proxy that you define, again, front ends, back ends, routing rules. And then for the back ends, you can make them dynamic. So you can say, this back end is subscribed to this app at this version. And then it listens. So it listens when you spin more servers up or spin them down. Or if you make a call to it to say, hey, now you're interested in version 3 instead of version 2, as it has changes, it'll dynamically template out the HA proxy configuration. And then HA proxy has this way of sort of gracefully restarting it and reloading config, where it spins up another process. And then hands file descriptors over from one to the other process without dropping connections, which was kind of key for us. So we've been using that now for about a year or so, and in the process of getting it together to release it. So there's about four processes. There's also like a real time dashboard thing that kind of lets you see all the activity happening across sort of the whole system. But it's been super successful. And the reason we picked HA proxy was that we had all these new things that we were building. We were doing lots of stuff with Node, and we wanted to like pick a really stable, dependable thing where we could in places, and then leave us open to sort of experiment or really push the edge in some other places. So it's really worked out well.
Neat.
Excellent. So are there any topics that we want to touch on while we're going into this, or should we dive into how we explore load and capacity for the future, provision load and capacity for the future? It's a great topic. And that's invariably, if you're tasked to create something with WebSockets, you're going to get asked this question. I think, how much can we take?
I guess if there was one more thing that I wanted to touch on, it's just if you happen to be doing WebSockets with Cluster, you should know about the Cluster load balancing bug. That we were hitting pretty badly. We were in the Ubuntu LTS on AWS, and we moved over to AWS. All of a sudden, after Hurricane Sandy, we started seeing these terrible imbalances between processes, this turns out to just be a symptom of Node.js referring that, or a cluster referring that down to the kernel. So now they're targeting a fix with Node 0.12. But this is just something to keep in mind if you're doing if you're using a bunch of processes under cluster with anything, but in particular with sockets with these very long lived connections, we were seeing like 50-to-1 imbalances and things like that. So it's just something to be conscious of. So that's me derailing your movement to part three, and I apologize for that.
That's a great discussion. So I'm curious why you decided to go with cluster, because I've always been kind of minus one on cluster with rich connections and WebSockets. It just seemed like there was a lot of opportunity for pain there, and it seems like you found some pain.
it basically worked awesome. Everything was perfect except for the load balancing.
Okay.
Which was, I guess they're gonna try round robin now. Now we have two layers of HAProxy. One. One sitting out front, and then one per machine to farm out amongst different processes. It's just an important thing to keep an eye on, right? Like, are your connections actually balanced across your node processes? But with HAProxy in front, there's little chance of that getting out of sync. But it's something that did bite us pretty badly. So don't take the same long route to figuring out what was going on that we did.
But why are you using two HA proxies instead of just one?
Because it's easier.
You could just add it the node process to the main balancer.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and we certainly considered doing that. We already had an HAProxy that was proxying between machines, so this way we could test it really easily, right? Using cluster versus this. It doesn't really. There's no real penalty performance-wise, as far as we can see. The local one, the local HAProxy doesn't. doesn't really. That's not enough load to get to an HAProxy instance, right? It makes it a little bit easier. For instance, the way that we take a web server out of service on HAProxy is to move a file. It's kind of cheesy. We just move a file that puts that makes the performance of a web server on that machine change. And then HAProxy says, "Oh, yep, that one's going out of service as of now." And so we had all of that in place. And so it was just very easy to swap them in and out.
So with either HAProxy, running locally or using the cluster module, would that be basically twice the file descriptors required, like on that machine?
Let's see. Yeah, it would, right?
I think so. I'm not sure about cluster. HAProxy, I would assume it would, because it's you're handling basically twice as many connections.
And it's been a while since I thought about it. Yeah, that sounds right.
So how big are you clustering? Are you just doing default clustering, or are you oversubscribing? Just for people who are considering going down that path.
And this is actually why I was considering bringing our DevOps Sven onto this call, because we will. I don't always have my terminology as well as I should. When you say default clustering versus oversubscribing, could you define those terms for me? Or yeah, feel free to retreat from this conversation if you feel like you're speaking to someone without the vocabulary.
With cluster, the default is number of CPUs for the number of processes it spins off to.
Yeah, we were Yeah, so I think we tried a bunch of different configurations actually. Mm-hmm. We're running on the and I also tend to forget AWS machine types, but we're running 32 processes on a 32 real core box on AWS. So and each of those is actually running. Each of those is clustering, has a two process cluster, and then all of those, each of those is in a two process cluster, and then HA proxy proxies between all of those so that we get, sort of failover at the very lowest level.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense. Right. Limiting that since you're running a bunch of other processes around it. Cool. That's a very interesting configuration.
Yeah, it seemed to be the.
I mean that in a good way.
Yeah. It was actually the result of a fair amount of experimentation on our end. It wasn't like the first thing we thought of either.
Awesome, cool. Any other AWS pain you want to?
The Elastic Load Balancer. We moved to AWS, like I say, without having done as much testing as we would have liked to after moving, after Sandy kind of pushed us out of our data center. Fortunately, most of the, a lot of the, the hard work for the move had already been done. So this would have been last November that we were having all these problems with it. And they called it a bug. And I frankly don't know if it's fixed. We had gone, we were using, the Elastic Load Balancer on the front end instead of HA proxy, and now we've gone to four HA proxy instances because it seemed like it was like a bunch of connections would get severed and then it would size down, and then sizing up, it would just fall over. So it's not like I'm trying to FUD the Elastic Load Balancer or anything, but we did have that problem, and it may still be a problem if anyone is considering going that route. Is anybody else using the Elastic Load Balancer?
Yeah, we have, and we've had a lot of problems.
Okay.
We've observed like a significant amount of latency that's added as well through the ELBs. As well as you have to do TCP based routing, and then you have to sort of do that in HA proxy too. But it's like this extra sort of layer, and then even that the ELBs still only work within a single region. So like you'd have to figure out how to do that across multiple regions anyway. It seems like if you're going to be running and proxying with something like HA proxy. Or Nginx or something like that. Anyway, it seems pretty unnecessary. I don't know anybody that's tried just using the ELB to proxy. I guess you could.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of pain and suffering with ELB, especially when it comes to WebSockets. But in general, it seems to be a little bit painful.
And the added latency, in the order of a lot of cases of like 200 milliseconds.
Oh my God. Wow.
Of just like added latency to the connection. It's really strange. So we're still, some of it's kind of anecdotal, like spot sort of checks and tests and stuff, but we're digging in a little bit more now and trying to find ways in the places that we're still using it to eliminate it.
Okay, so it sounds like similar experiences all around, or some similar experiences and similar anecdotes coming from other places. Okay, that's good to know. I didn't know what the word on the street was about ELB these days.
That's why we get together and share our pain.
Huh.
Cool. Any other topics we want to hit on before we go into load and capacity testing?
I mean, the one thing to mention, the last, is about, especially with Socket.io, since we started off talking about Socket.io, is that especially if you're going to use any of them, if you're going to use Socket.io, you're probably going to use any of the not like persistent connection transports. And if you're going to do that, you absolutely need to do, sticky session-based routing. The nice thing about HA proxy is it could do that, like connection based routing, not just cookie-based routing. If you're doing long polling and you're disconnecting and reconnecting, you need to make sure that it heads to the same node. That can cause other types of DOS-type issues if you get that wrong. Experienced some of that in the past, too. So
that was actually one of the reasons why the Socket.io store was invented. I mean, what the Socket.io store is actually doing is syncing all the handshake information and connection information between every connected node instance in your cluster. So if a connection enters a different node process than it started with, it can still answer the request. But yeah, this solution doesn't really scale mm-hmm. because if you have like 20,000 concurrent connections and four processes, all of these four processes will have the information of those 20,000 connections.
Yeah, and it sounds good in concept, but I've definitely had problems even when we were using the Redis store with that. And it would work sometimes, and then other times it would get in this weird loop again where it constantly is trying to like reestablish and reconnect and gets in, you know, the loops, the similar type of loops that you mentioned earlier. But
yeah, but also adding new nodes to your cluster would be really painful with the current Redis store. I mean, you have to turn off your complete cluster, bring up a node and bring it back online because it's syncing all this data and it's not storing it anywhere in the database. So you will have the, like this misconnections and stuff. It's just annoying.
Yeah.
Okay, so began to introduce this a couple minutes ago. I definitely hit this at Spreecast. And so as you're pushing the boundaries of what the current modules and you know, the capabilities can do, you invariably will get asked it, you know, by someone upstream, you know, how much can this do? How much can we hold? How do you you know, push the boundaries of capacity testing? When what can you do to more effectively answer that question? Because there are a lot of well, it depends in that, you know, how big your data is, how complex your data is, how interconnected your users are.
How many messages you sent.
Right. So what have you guys been able to accomplish effectively, and what are the things that you found that you just cannot know? Don't everybody jump in.
I was just rolling my own, you know, testing, trying to test WebSockets and what they could do. And, you know, I learned really quickly that, for instance, our, you know, I was testing locally, well, being a, not knowing what I was doing, I was testing over our link to our data center at the time. And man, I took that thing down, no problem. I mean, you know, you really need to be, you know, you really need to be on the same network, which I suppose is probably obvious to everybody else, but I managed to screw it up. So, but yeah, it's actually kind of, I mean, I think it's really difficult to test, to realistically test, you know, what's going to happen with, you know, socket load when you've got, you know, when you're under realistic conditions, unless you have some, you know, some way of replaying it, which is tough.
And the biggest problem that people are doing is that they're only testing WebSocket connections against their Socket.io server, but they're forgetting that a lot of people are actually connecting using polling. And polling is a lot heavier than just plain old WebSockets.
Yeah, and I found it's really difficult. I've found it. I was really interested to hear what knowledge they've gleaned. So I found it really difficult to create a realistic test. So the approach I've used at times in the past is to try to find places to embed little experiments. And that's even, you know, friends that have, you know, pretty popular, highly cached, you know, WordPress blogs and things that they allow me to drop a script tag in for a day and do some experimenting. I created this thing called ProBio quite a while ago. That was like one of the first attempts at that, of trying to gather those types of statistics, just even to know, like, well, in a typical user scenario, like how many people would even be able to connect with a WebSocket versus another transport, and of those people, was it which browsers were they connecting to, and trying to get some sense of, even if I was going to create some kind of a synthetic type load test, you know, what, how would I break that down in a real user, real type, you know, usage scenario? So at least I found those tests to be at least a little more realistic. But, you know, still, still very much a challenge, right? And, you know, you're trying to, and even those scenarios where do no harm, but there's lots of opportunities to sort of do harm in place, which is why I try to find sort of low risk places to put them.
So it sounds like it's still an open question, but I think, you know, it's an open question, but it's just an extraordinarily hard to provision question. So you really need to provision out basically the infrastructure to real hardware, real spec space to get to the point where they can actually do that.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, if you want to run, I mean, you know, the most effective, information we've gotten obviously is from production. I guess that kind of goes without saying. But you know, right. We have the luxury, because you know, absolutely real time updates are not, you know, they're not essential to the operation of the product, right? If you don't get, like, somebody moves a card and you don't see it for 10 seconds, that makes Trello less magical, but it doesn't make it not work. Right, just because of the nature of the kind of edits that we're doing there. So, you know, being able to turn WebSockets on for, you know, 10%, you know, for 1%, then 5%, then 10%. And other than that, having the ability to say, okay, the whole thing works if everybody's on polling and idle people poll every 10 seconds and active people poll every 3 seconds, and it's not awful, you know. Being able to do that and then ramp it up, you know, is cool. But not everybody's going to have that luxury, right? Not every, there's a lot of, you know, things where the conflicts would be so bad that you just couldn't even do that, right? Or like a game or something. Obviously, you couldn't do it there. Where possible, you know, being able to fall back to polling where you have a lot of control over the polling interval. And thus a lot of control over the load, at least that puts on your servers, can be a nice thing, especially if you can handle everybody without keeping the HTTP connections alive if necessary. But anyway, that's really not about link capacity testing. That's more like, you know, being able to ease it into production.
Well, I think that's a great, you know, way to solve the problem. If you have sensible fallbacks in place that, you know, all of what we're doing is providing a service to our users. You know, if that service is not in place, they derive no value from it. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it has fancy WebSockets or whatever underneath it. You know, they all they see is, you know, that your software is broken.
True that.
Yeah.
The biggest problem that I've seen with low capacity testing with real-time connections is that there are so much different things that you have to test. I mean, you have to test with a lot of long-running connections, but also short-running connections. You have different sizes of messages to take in account, different types of messages, binary versus just plain text. I mean, all these kinds of different options need to be tested, and that's really hard to do because you don't always know how many long-running connections you have or how many people are just refreshing the browser and creating a lot of short-running connections.
Right on.
So when I was testing the load balancer battle, I also noticed that there wasn't any tooling around benchmarking WebSocket connections. If you want to test HTTP connections, you have AB or Siege or HTTP Pref or Work. But for WebSockets, you basically have nothing. So the only thing that I had left to do was build my own testing tool for WebSockets. I mean, there was one earlier. It was built by Peter Grice. I think it was called WS Bench.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was... Right? Yeah, it was a long time ago. It was fairly outdated. It doesn't support all the specifications. I built Tor to generate load for my WebSocket connections, and it's been doing it really nicely. But the biggest problem with that I ran into it is kind of the same problem that Brad was having, and that's it's using cluster internally, so the connections aren't that load balanced. So you will end up with one single node with like tens of thousands of connections and one single node with like 10 connections. So there isn't any reliable tooling around WebSocket benchmarking yet. And that's a shame.
Right on. Yeah, that'd be good to... Like, if someone wants to step up and do that, it's something, since Peter Grease's project, that's a big need. So you get a lot of love and appreciation from that.
You know, yes. I would. But I don't think I could come up with a better name than Thor. Like I'm just like, I can't even start. I mean, I read through this and I read through the results and I looked through it. And I'm like, oh, what's Thor? And I'm like, Thor, God of Thunder, Son of Odin, and Smasher WebSockets. So I was like, yes. I can't do it.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So we do have one question before we sort of wrap up this discussion of WebSockets and scaling them. So the question is from, who is this? From Hank Hendricks. Would it be feasible to use sockets with an in-browser FPS, first-person shooter? Is that actually possible?
You bet.
I think so, yeah. So what you would do is first-person shooters cheat, right? They accomplish their magic with lots of algorithmic cheating. So, you know, one thing that you have to consider is all the extra work that goes into making a good first-person shooter. But if you were to limit your application to, you know, very good ping times or something like that, the challenges here are game design, not transport architecture, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right on. I mean, I think they're not going to, you know, they're not going to add a huge amount of additional latency. It's just, you know, how fast can you get the data to the server and to the, into the other player. But I mean, not that I'm a game design guru. My game is awful. But they're not, but yeah, I mean, they actually do at least over SSL, which might be limiting, but, they do stay connected really well, and the additional latency after you're connected isn't too bad. I mean, it's really pretty neat. Everybody like tried out, what's it called, Rump Patrol? The tadpole thing with WebSockets. This was like 2 years ago. You guys remember this? No. Okay. No, it was cool.
RUM.
Rump Patrol. I think it's a Scandinavian word for like tadpole or something. Anyway, but it was just a bunch of little tadpoles swimming around and interacting with each other, and it was, you know, it handled a bunch and it was pretty neat. But I don't see any reason why it wouldn't work. Somebody must have done this, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that if you dig a little deeper on this topic, there are people that are building that, and I've been using that.
I was on mute. You know, I'm struggling here. Didn't someone from Google report? No, like, it listened to me the whole time, but not now. Didn't someone at Google? I think they ended up porting, it was either Doom or Quake 2 through like with GWT, and that used WebSockets, right?
They used WebSockets, yeah.
Hmm. Right on. There you go.
I didn't try it, but yeah, it was all the buzz a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah, it was a while ago, but it looked. I saw it demoed. It was very cool, but so it can be done. I don't think it's any different than, you know, building distributed games over, you know, potentially high latency networks and all the sort of what game developers, I guess, would call some of the physics around doing that. And, you know, very similar challenges, whether it's a WebSocket or not. And I think, you know, if you're using WebSockets, there's the typical things you'd write is you have to deal with the latency. You have to deal with the types of messages and the sizes of messages and how you're handling those messages, both of, you know, and again, as I mentioned before, if you're sending JSON, you're doing lots of, like, you know, doing JSON, you know, parses is something that can certainly, you know, either bring Volthy or server browser to a crawl. So avoiding those types of things if you can, et cetera.
Right, and like just first person shooter and gaming architectures are generally going to go as low level as possible just to eke out all the performance that they can. So one last question, and I'm going to close questions with this. So Sakadeo, does it support handling binary data or no?
Don't remember.
Third Eden's gone to sleep. So I actually didn't answer this question.
I was on mute. I've been screaming in the mic. I was, no! No, it doesn't support binary at all. I mean, the biggest problem with it is that you have different transports in Socket.io, and not all of these transports support binary. The only transport that would be able to support binary would be WebSockets. So it doesn't make sense to have Socket.io and only run WebSockets. You might as well just run a plain WebSocket server.
So if you want to do that, you might, you know, go out to the lower level infrastructure.
Yeah, or you can just base encode everything. There's also a project called Binary.js, mm-hmm. which does basically the same, but it makes it easier for you to send binary data over WebSockets, and I think they also did it another connection.
Right. Okay, so any closing thoughts or shout-outs before we go into conferences and that stuff? No? All right. So a couple quick upcoming events, and then we'll do shout-outs and our plugs. A new meetup group has started in the north of England, Node Up North. So this is the north of England, not New England. When I originally read that, I assumed that it was up north since Craig added this one. So the Node Up North group in England will be running meetings the second Wednesday of every month, and food and whatnot are provided. Go check them out at meetup.com, Node Up North, all together as the identifier for that meetup. Good to have you guys around. So April 22nd to 23rd, Real-Time Conf EU is coming to Europe. I know Arno is speaking, and there's still a few tickets available. So go participate, support that. Real-Time Conf is one of my all-time favorite conferences. It's a great opportunity to step outside of the Node community and compare notes with people who are solving similar problems with different approaches. And it will be on a boat. So cool stuff there. Another conference with some tickets. So in conjunction with JSConf, JSConf is super sold out. But if you can make your way to Amelia Island, CSSConf is May 28th. Go to that. That sounds like a lot of fun. And check out CSSConf. And last but not least, at the end of June, the 22nd through the 30th, NodeConf is going to be held at Walker Creek Ranch. Some of the counselors include myself, Isaac Substack, Max Ogden, Dominic Tarr, Dominic DiDicola. Nexu will be there, and it is the Node event of the year. We're merging the sort of speakery NodeConf with summer camp this year, and it's going to be very interesting and much larger than the summer camps that if you've been to that in the past, a longer, more extended experience, and Michael has a bunch of surprises for everybody in store for that. So come to NodeConf. And if you haven't gotten your ticket yet, go book it now. All right, plugs. Quick plug for me. Voxer has a new front-end team that's forming. You know, ping me if you're interested in that and join that team. There'll be a link in the show notes.
Quick plug from me. Help us build Tor to the best WebSocket load testing utility there is and contribute to the project. It's github.com/observing/Tor.
That's awesome. I love that name. And this is Mike. So I'm a co-organizer of Denver.js, which is the local meetup in the Front Range, Colorado, Denver, Boulder area. We meet usually the first Thursday of the month, and you know, looking for speakers, and you know, have a pretty good attendance so far. Usually it's about 60, 70 people. So we've got plenty of room, love for people in the area to come out. And if you're interested in speaking, even if you're out of town, we're pulling together a sponsorship to make that happen. Who knows, maybe it'll become a conference someday.
Try Trello for all of your awesome lightweight project management needs. It's what I work on. It's written in Node. I love it. Let us know what you like and what you don't. And obviously, just a huge thanks to everybody who's written all of these amazing things that you know, let us develop totally in the future. Some of whom are on this call. Thanks a lot, y'all. It's a great time to be a programmer.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Arno. Thanks, Mike. And thanks, Brett, for coming on and sharing. I think this will be a fantastic resource for people who are rolling out WebSockets and Socketeo. I really appreciate you guys coming on. So be sure to leave a review on iTunes. It keeps NodeUp relevant in Apple's algorithms. So leave a review. Follow NodeUp on Twitter at NodeUp. And we will talk to you soon. Thank you, everybody.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
See ya.
Thanks, y'all.